Sun is out. A little bit of a breeze from the southwest at 3. 21 degrees for both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. It seems very appropriate that someone with the name of McGuire is our morning show guest today, namely Tip McGuire, who represents the 64th Assembly District, which includes, of course, much of Kenosha. And Tip McGuire is paying his first visit to the morning show, and we're going to be talking with him, first of all, a bit of his background in terms of where he comes from originally, his journey of public service, which included a stint as former assistant district attorney in Milwaukee County, and this move then to be a part of the state assembly. And of course, it is tumultuous times in which to be in the public eye and with a closely divided state assembly and state senate. It's an interesting time, to say the least, to be in this line of work, if you will. And I'm excited that we can speak with Tim McGuire for the next few minutes about this and more. Tip McGuire, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Gregory, and it's certainly an honor to be here.
Happy to we can have this first of what I hope will be a number of conversations on the morning show. Let's begin by hearing a little bit about where you come from originally. I do know that you were born in Summers. Have you pretty much remained your entire life right here in southeastern Wisconsin?
I would say yes. As a general rule, I went away to college and I went to law school I went to college at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and then I went to law school at the University of Wisconsin. Throughout that time, I obviously wasn't living at home. I also spent in between undergraduate and law school, I spent 5 years working for my predecessor in the state assembly, actually Peter Barca. And so I was sort of back and forth from Madison to Kenosha an awful lot during that time. So I guess I would say there were periods where I was in Madison and periods where I was significantly in Kenosha during that time. But as a general rule, Kenosha has been my home my whole life.
Tell us what prompted you to want to pursue the law and to become an attorney. Was that first of all something that was part of maybe your own family's legacy, or was somebody or something a particular inspiration or catalyst for you?
Well, I would say that certainly within my family there are an awful lot of lawyers. My grandfather, Martin Antaramian, had a law firm in town. My cousin, Michael Easton, has a law firm in town. There's several lawyers within the family, but I think what, unlike them, I didn't have the intention of going into private practice. I chose to go to law school because I wanted to be a prosecutor. I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for people who are victims of crimes and people who have experienced that kind of trauma, and so I went to law school with the express purpose of doing that, and I was grateful for the opportunity to do that both in the Kenosha District Attorney's Office as well as in the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office after I completed my degree.
Very good. Tell us what you feel are the most significant lasting benefits, if you will, of having served as assistant district attorney in Milwaukee County. I suspect one sees a lot and experiences a great deal. What has been maybe most directly valuable to you in what you are doing now as a state representative?
Yeah, well, I guess there's a couple of benefits. The first is, the Kenosha County Courthouse was a wonderful experience to learn in, especially because there are so many great and qualified prosecutors that have been in Kenosha for so long. And so there was really a lot of time to sort of learn the function of a prosecutor and learn the work that district attorneys do and the ways to approach cases. There's a stark difference, though, between how Kenosha County operates and how Milwaukee County operates. Milwaukee County is the most is the busiest courthouse in the state, and so you have a lot of cases, and there are a lot of very rapid decisions that have to be made. And so I'm very grateful I had the experience in Kenosha to kind of learn how to approach the law using our Kenosha perspective. And then when I was in Milwaukee, I learned how to use that approach rapidly and to understand the law in a deeper way simply by having to make quick arguments and quick decisions and be able to go to trial at the drop of a hat, frankly. You know, the example that I give people is in my first year in the Kenosha DA's office, I did 6 jury trials, which is not a minor amount. And then in my first year in the Milwaukee DA's office, I did 17 jury trials.
Wow.
It's a significantly different workload, and I'm frankly grateful for both experiences.
You already mentioned that you worked for a time for your predecessor, Peter Barca. Tell us
yes.
What was maybe most eye-opening. I suspect that one goes into that maybe imagining it will be a certain experience, and it probably ends up being replete with all kinds of surprises, maybe some of them not even all that pleasant in terms of what the day-to-day life for a state representative is.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, that was also during a pretty tumultuous time in Wisconsin politics. That was when Scott Walker was removing workers' rights, and there were pretty significant protests in opposition to that. There was recall of an attempted recall of Governor Walker. It was a very tumultuous time in Wisconsin politics then as well. But what I think I learned most about was ultimately, especially for many pieces of legislation, the devil and God are in the details. That many bills can sound wonderful on their face, but really it's some small narrow changes that can have the biggest impact on how people live their lives and on the way that they can proceed. And so paying close attention to the bills that are coming through is pretty vital for a legislator. It can't just be, you know, I think sometimes headlines oversimplify what legislation does. And in reality, you know, these are lengthy documents that have lots of changes within them, and some can be good, some can be bad. And there's a lot of weighing the cost and benefit. But there's also pieces of them that can cross a line that can't be uncrossed, and that may not be in the, you know, the title of the bill. The title of the bill may sound perfectly wonderful, but there may be pieces within it that are truly bad for working people and for our communities and for our neighborhoods and for our families.
We're speaking with Tip McGuire, who is representing the 64th Assembly District, and we'll be talking in just a moment about Governor Evers' proposed budget. Talk for a moment about the decision to run for office and what prompted you to want to do that. And even as you went to work for Representative Barca, was it at least with that possibility in mind that this might perhaps be a pathway for you to serve the citizens of southeastern Wisconsin in a similar way? Or is there something else that drew you into the political fray?
Well, I would say I don't believe that I had very serious intentions of running for office for the period that I worked for Representative Barca, or I guess Secretary Barca. But the same reason that I chose to go work for him is the same reason that I chose to run for office, which is I love my hometown. I love Kenosha. I love Summers. I want to make sure that our region is as strong as possible. And I believe that for 50 years in this country, working people have been getting the short end of the stick, that this has been a pretty coordinated and consistent effort to undermine the institutions that benefit regular Americans and regular Wisconsinites. And I ran for office in 2019 in the hopes that Governor Evers' election and the election of others in to statewide Wisconsin positions, that this was the beginning of a new era where we could be bringing back those institutions and strengthening institutions and strengthening laws and doing things to protect and enhance the lives of regular Wisconsinites. And I guess the easy examples to this would be things like expanding Medicaid, which unfortunately the state still hasn't done, is accepting federal Medicaid dollars so that every Wisconsinite can have access to affordable health care. I think that that is something that we should have done many years ago. I think it's frankly disgraceful that Governor Walker refused to accept those dollars and that legislative Republicans refused to do that. And we're still at the same place right now. I ran for office because I believe that our public schools should be sources of strength for our community. They should be places where children have the opportunity to learn and grow and then be able to pick their own future. And unfortunately, after years of being underfunded, we still haven't gotten there. And so the reasons that I ran for office initially, we are working on making them better every day. And we have had some victories, but there's still a long way to go.
We're speaking with Tip McGuire, who represents the 64th Assembly District. Before we go any further, maybe you can clarify for our listeners, particularly because some boundaries have shifted. I don't remember in the case of the 64th how significant those changes are, but explain to our listeners exactly what the boundaries of the 64th Assembly District are.
So it's hard to identify streets since it's not necessarily straight lines, but the
sure.
easiest parameters are on the north side, my district ends at County Road KR. On the west side, my district ends at I-94 and then heads east from I-94 to the shore, as I tell people. And then on, I guess you could say it's the north and west sides of the city of Kenosha, and then the village and town of Summers would be the best way of defining it.
So Summers, where you were born, is part of your district then?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Explain how you run your own office and the ways in which you seek to connect with your constituents, because there are, of course, different philosophies around what is the most effective and appropriate way to do that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways in which I seek to connect with constituents. The first thing that I will let our listeners know, though, is that I live in Kenosha. I live on the north side of Kenosha. I am there every week, so except for the time period where I have to be in Madison. So when you, if you're ever concerned about something or you have any questions, feel free to give my office a call. Our phone number is 608-266-5504. You can shoot me an email. I am the only TIP in the legislature, so it's pretty easy to find me if you want to Google and find our email. But it really is just rep.mcguire@legis.wi.gov. But shoot us an email, give us a call, and if you ever want to sit down and chat or get a cup of coffee, I'm happy to do that. I do that with constituents relatively frequently. I also have enjoyed going out and knocking doors throughout the legislative session to check in with folks. We are holding a listening session. I believe it's March 27th at 6 p.m. at the Southwest Library. Senator Wirch, our newly elected Representative Ben DeSchmidt, and I will be having a listening session to discuss the governor's budget. And then, you know, I try to make as many events as I possibly can and make sure that I'm connecting with people there. We do send out a newsletter so that people have all the contact information that they would need throughout our district. And, Frankly, Gregory, one of the happiest parts of this job is being able to connect with the people that I serve. I think that Kenosha is just full of wonderful people, and it has been my whole life. And so people should feel free to reach out anytime they can. I would love to sit and chat with them. Mm.
I think I made passing reference to the fact that right now the State Assembly and the State Senate are more closely balanced than had been the case before. Although still under control of the Republicans, it is by a slimmer margin after the most recent elections. I wonder, as someone who has been a part of the State Assembly since 2019, how would you characterize sort of the state of affairs right now and the way in which the two parties are working together and or failing to work together?
Well, I'll say this. I think that Wisconsin has certainly been very divided politically in the legislature for a long time. I think that there are some harsh feelings that have developed as a result, and that I think we're still working on getting over the bad habit of hyperpartisanship. But I think that there have been some signs of potential opportunities of areas that we can agree on. I am concerned about recent reports from some journalists from some talk radio hosts that some Republicans believe that the best path forward is to simply not pass a state budget this year. I think that that would be very devastating for our state. I think that that would lead to bad outcomes for our cities and for our schools and as well as for our transportation projects. And so I think it's very important that we do get together and find a way to pass a budget together, one that can be passed through the legislature and one that can be signed by the governor, as has been done in every budget prior to this. I'm concerned that some people still want to continue the bad habit of hyperpartisanship, but I'm always optimistic. I'm always hopeful that the members of the legislature, many of whom I know well, some of whom I've worked together to pass bipartisan bills in the past, I'm hopeful that the reasonable folks are going to carry the day here.
How would you summarize the budget proposed by Governor Evers? And did it contain any surprises for you?
Well, I would summarize it as an investment in working Wisconsinites. And as he said in his statement, it's the year of the kids. And he wants to invest in our children and making sure that our children have the brightest possible future. Now, there were some surprises in there. I did not expect the governor to include a provision that allows us, that would make Wisconsin the first state in the country to be able to audit health insurance companies that are denying people claims. And while I didn't expect it, I certainly support it. I think that we've heard time and again, and I'm sure you've heard this from people in your life, but people have claims denied that appear to be meritless denials. And it, for some insurance companies, perhaps this is a matter of doing business as to whether they deny it the first time or not. And we can't really know unless we take a deeper look. And so I'm excited that we have the opportunity to have an audit of these large health insurance companies that are denying claims and that have particularly high rates of denial of claims. And so, but again, that was a bit of a surprise to me. What wasn't a surprise, though, and some things that I think that the governor has been very consistent on, is the investment in public education, the investment in healthcare, and in making sure that working families have the affordability crisis addressed. There are a couple of provisions in there that I think that are really important to highlight some of the challenges that people have been facing. And here's the easiest one. Over the past year, communities across Wisconsin have faced the question of a referendum to fund their local schools. And we had one in Kenosha that did not succeed. And in communities across the state, they had ones that did not succeed. And I empathize with people that the choice between raising your own property taxes or funding your child's education is a difficult one. And so Governor Evers recognized that. And so in his budget, he did two things. He increased funding for public schools so that they wouldn't have these funding gaps, especially by increasing the special education reimbursement rate, which is a very technical thing. But basically, the state promised that we would give school districts 60% of these funds when Tommy Thompson was governor, and that we've been failing to do that, and we're only giving them about 30% of these funds. And so they're having to manage their budgets by moving money around and making sure that they're still covering those services, and it harms the education of every child in the state. Mm-hmm. So by increasing that, he's helped invest in public education, but alternatively, he's also provided dollars for property tax relief. And I think that's important. I think that's a good recognition of the challenge that so many working families and working Wisconsinites have faced over the last couple of years with all of these referendums, being proposed locally. That's one example. I would also say the healthy meals for kids in schools. What our studies show is that for families that send their kids to school, this would save about $1,800 a year for working families. And so that's an opportunity to save families money on groceries by helping provide healthier meals for kids at schools and making sure that every kid is eating so that they can learn and be the best that they can be. Mm.
Certainly for a school district like Kenosha and other metropolitan area school districts, there have been complaints for many, many years that there is something not quite right about the formula by which aid to public schools is calculated, and that somehow a school district like KUSD is not receiving the funding that is appropriate for a school district of that size and of that complexity. What can you tell us about that formula, if there is indeed something amiss, and if there is any realistic possibility of that formula being reshaped or recalculated in some way so that a school district like Kenosha Unified can be better served?
Yeah, so, I don't claim to be an expert on the school funding formula. I will say that it has been a very long time since it has been addressed and altered to match the realities of that different school districts are facing. And so I would certainly be open to taking a closer look at that. I'll say I don't have any anticipation that that is going to happen this session or that there is any realistic chance of something like that moving forward in through this legislature. I don't think that is something that they're interested in doing at all. And we would still have to pass it through a majority Republican body. That said, in my conversations with our school officials and our school board and others, it's my understanding that many of the changes that were proposed in the governor's budget, especially the special education reimbursement, in which the local district has been taking, essentially a loss for quite a while, that if we were to address that, that would help significantly reduce the budget gap that KUSD currently finds itself in. And I think that we should start with that. That's something that is concretely in the budget. It is something that the state has promised it would do and has failed to do so. And so if we fulfill our promise this year, it will be helping KUSD and school districts across the state to be able to make their budget and ensure that our kids have a good education.
We should talk for a moment about higher education, because, of course, that is also something that Governor Evers is seeking to address in his budget proposal with significantly increased funding for the UW system. What do you make of the governor's proposal on this?
Well, I appreciated the governor's proposal. My father taught at Parkside, UW Parkside, for over 30 years, Patrick McGuire. And I have, as I'm sure you get, a lot of affection for that institution. And I see the way that it benefits our community and the kids that can go there and that can enter the workforce and the relationship, the strong relationship it has with local employers to make sure that they have the workers that they need to make their businesses succeed. And so I think that we have such a great example of what the University of Wisconsin system can do. And then over time, as we've seen, there has been the gradual underfunding and defunding of the UW system as its percentage that it receives from the state has shrunk. And frankly, I think there was a study that came out earlier this year, and I don't remember exactly where we ranked anymore. It was above 40th, though, I believe, in the country in the state's investment in higher education. And for years, the University of Wisconsin system has been a source of strength for Wisconsin. It's what's brought researchers to Wisconsin. It's what's brought new technologies to Wisconsin. It's what's brought students to Wisconsin who come and stay and help build our community. And so for us to strengthen it, I think would help strengthen all of those avenues. It would help Wisconsin with our long-term workforce shortage questions. It would help Wisconsin with our innovation and our ability to start new businesses and create new jobs for people throughout the state. It would help Wisconsin by making sure that the state is attracting and bringing in younger people and people who can start families and help our communities grow and build on that. So I'm very pleased to see that the governor has a significant investment in the UW system. I am, as always, skeptical about the capacity of legislative Republicans to support the University of Wisconsin system, since they have continually not done that. And so I'm hopeful that this session I'll be proven wrong, that we can all get together and agree that the University of Wisconsin is one of the great prides and joys of this state, and so we should be making that investment.
Let's talk for a moment about another significant portion of the governor's proposed budget, $50 million, I believe, to cities, towns, and villages to expand and improve emergency medical services. Can you tell us, as far as you believe, what has prompted the governor to want to propose this kind of money? What kind of a deficit of services are we talking about?
So offhand, I guess I don't know the specific provision you're referencing, but I'll say I do know that there's sort of two joint problems that that we can see. One is that we obviously believe that cities have similarly had for many years very stagnant rates of support from the state. And so last session, we were able to pass an increase in shared revenue. But if you ask the Kenosha mayor, who, you know, I worked very closely with in trying to get that shared revenue increase for Kenosha, and we were able to get a 20% increase, the year-over-year totals that he's getting now are simply just going to not be enough to maintain and to keep our services as strong as they should be. And so any additional assistance from the state is certainly something that I would support, especially at a time when we have a $4.3 billion surplus. We want to make sure that our cities are strong and that they can make sure that people have fire and police support and that they can make sure that people, you know, get exactly the services that they need. That said, I'll also say we have, you know, as a consequence of some of the reimbursement rates that different organizations receive for medical care. And again, I'm not certain I know which provision you're specifically referencing. But we have seen that some emergency rooms have struggled to stay afloat, and so perhaps this money, this provision you're referencing, goes directly to assisting cities to maintain that, I guess. I don't know, again, what the actual details of the provision you're referencing are.
Well, and this is as good a time as any to underscore the fact that a budget proposal, such as what Governor Evers has put forth, is a massive document and incredibly complex that I can't even fathom the challenge it is for you as legislators to just make your way through all of that in order to, in a sense, make sense of it and then be able to advocate for it. It's no small matter.
Well, and I'll say, you know, I'm currently the ranking Democrat on the Joint Finance Committee, which is the Budget Committee, ranking Democrat for the Assembly. And so not only do I have to read through all of it, I have to be able to explain it to many of my colleagues. And so as soon as you had said that provision, I thought, boy, I haven't memorized as much of it as I had hoped to. So I'll have to go and look that up.
Right. Let's talk for a moment about expansion of Badger Care and what that would mean as far as you're concerned in terms of making a positive difference in the life of a lot of Wisconsin citizens.
Well, certainly. So the expansion of Medicaid, and that's what we call Badger Care, or that's what Badger Care is on the federal level, the expansion of Medicaid for Wisconsin would do a couple of things. So first of all, it would have allowed us to accept federal dollars that we could bring into the state and use for additional programs that help pay to benefit the health and safety of Wisconsinites. But then it also would have made sure that the approximately 90,000 Wisconsinites who currently don't have access to coverage because they fall into a gap that exists under the federal law between how Medicaid laws existed prior to Obamacare and after Obamacare, and we're still sort of existing in that pre-Obamacare Medicaid because we never accepted the dollars. And if you're thinking to yourself, boy, Obamacare, wasn't that like 15 years ago? It was. And there are only, I think, 10 or fewer states left in the country that have not accepted these dollars. This is not really a partisan issue at this point, as many red states and blue states have accepted these dollars and used it to invest in medical care for Wisconsinites, for their residents. But we haven't done the same thing for Wisconsinites. And that's a problem, is that we could have accepted these dollars. We could have used, you know, in a myriad ways. The governor has put forth his proposal on how these dollars could be invested, making sure that people have access to care, and making sure that we are lowering Wisconsin's infant mortality rate, which in some communities is quite high, in ways that he could invest in providing prenatal care for pregnant mothers, making sure that we have postpartum care for mothers after they give birth, and a number of things that would be really important and would help make sure that we have healthy kids and healthy families in Wisconsin. But there's also, I'm sure, other investments that could be discussed. But we have to start with expanding Medicaid and accepting those dollars and investing those in Wisconsinites. And we can discuss the ways. I'm sure that there are other reasonable minds may differ on ways that we could be using those dollars to benefit Wisconsinites. But certainly continuing to hold up our nose at the concept of accepting federal dollars for health care in Wisconsin is not the right approach.
Any other significant aspects of the governor's budget proposal that you want to highlight for us?
Well, I do think it's very important to discuss the work that we're doing to help make sure that our schools benefit, and the work that the governor is doing to help make sure that life is more affordable for Wisconsinites. One thing that we have talked about in the past has been an investment in childcare. And unfortunately, we continue to see childcare providers who are caught between a rock and a hard place. They either cannot pay their workers well enough to attract workers in to be able to use the full capacity of their facilities and then have more families, or not raise rates. And so as they're stuck between this question of raising rates on an already overwhelming cost to working families, the cost of childcare, or not using the fullness of their facilities and therefore having a scarcity of childcare in a region, what we ultimately see are families that choose to say, well, you know, childcare is so expensive, maybe one of us shouldn't work. And while there's nothing wrong with that, if that works best for the family, it does exacerbate our existing workforce shortage, where we don't have enough workers to fill positions. And so as we're seeing this problem for employers and for all sorts of institutions across Wisconsin where they can't seem to find workers, the fact that we aren't making the critical investment in childcare is a problem. And the governor, to his credit, you know, he had introduced the Child Care Counts program into his budget last session, and we fought pretty hard for it. And when legislative Republicans ultimately said no to that investment in childcare, the governor was able to shake out the couch cushions and find some money in the federal dollars that we had received that could be applied to it. Now, it wasn't enough, and it certainly wasn't the full amount that would help this program stay afloat and help make sure that we were helping childcare providers have the workers that they need to expand to full capacity and allow more childcare space. But this session, that won't be available to us. He shook out the couch cushions already, so there's not going to be extra money that's available to keep that program afloat. And so we need it to go through the legislature. We absolutely need them to support that, so that regular working people can still afford to put their kid in childcare and can still afford to go to their job.
We're speaking with Tip McGuire, who represents the 64th Assembly District, and we are talking about certain provisions of the state budget proposed by Governor Tony Evers. So you are in a very good position to explain to our listeners the process that goes forward from here, and also the specific role that you will play in terms of the committee on which you sit. Remind us again of what committee that is?
That's the Joint Finance Committee.
Right. So explain what the process is from here, because, of course, I think anybody listening is well aware that what Governor Evers has proposed will not remain unscathed. All kinds of objections have already been raised about this proposal. So what is the process that occurs from this point on?
Yeah, so the process is a little lengthy, but it's certainly one of the great parts about it is that it emphasizes within our state's process, it emphasizes hearing from Wisconsinites. So in the month of April, we will have four listening sessions across the state as a Joint Finance Committee. And the great part about these listening sessions is that the committee themselves are not permitted to speak. And so it is only members of the community who can come forward and testify to provisions that they would like to see in our state budget and things that they would like to have for their community. So those four locations and dates will be announced in the coming weeks. I unfortunately, I don't have any full confirmation of those. Otherwise, I'd let you know right now. But I will say, I believe that there will be one in southeastern Wisconsin in sort of the suburban Milwaukee area. So if you or any of your listeners would like to attend and would like to take the opportunity to testify in favor of something, you should absolutely come. And I would suggest getting there as early as possible, as there tends to be a bit of a line for the opportunity to testify. On top of that, members of the legislature will be having listening sessions themselves in their district. Like I said earlier, Senator Wirch, Representative DeSchmidt, and I will be having a listening session at the Southwest Library in Kenosha on March 27th at 6 p.m., and we'd love to see you or your listeners there to hear about what they would like to see from their budget. Now, once we're done with the listening session, the Joint Finance Committee may have agencies in for agency briefings on what their asks this cycle were and what they're looking for. And then following that, we'll basically go through each agency's budget and argue and debate over which provisions should be included in the budget, and then we'll take a vote on them. Unfortunately for me, I'm in the minority party, and so a lot of the ability of provisions to stay rests on the persuasiveness of our arguments, as well as the work that residents have done to push for those provisions. And of course, as it relates to how well Republicans are listening to the people that are contacting them and letting them know that those things need to be invested in. Once those votes are completed for each agency, the final budget then of those budget items will be passed out of the Finance Committee and then sent to the floor of the legislature, where the Assembly and the Senate will have their ability to amend, have their say, or pass it as it's already been completed through the Joint Finance Committee. And then the governor will have the opportunity to line item veto that budget, where he crosses out certain provisions. He'll have the ability to veto the budget in whole, or he'll have the ability to sign the budget in whole. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we've heard some disturbing talk that there is some folks who don't want to have a budget at all this session. Obviously, that would negate that entire process. And so choosing to actively not pass a budget would, I think, be very devastating. There's a lot of parts of our state budget that relate to new information that we receive every 2 years. So some of that could be the population of a school or a school district and how that relates to the amount of school aid they receive. Some of that could be transportation projects, road building or fixing roads, expanding roads, new projects that come along that need to be passed and funded for them to proceed. And so there's a lot at stake in not passing a budget. And so I'm very hopeful that the cooler heads will prevail and that we will decide to get together and debate and discuss and talk about the value of provisions, and then ultimately have a budget that the governor can sign and that we can move forward with as a state. Hmm.
Remind our listeners once again of the phone number if they want to contact your office.
Of course, 608-266-5504.
Very good. Tip McGuire represents the 64th Assembly District. Mr. McGuire, it's been great to speak with you today on the morning show. Thank you so much for making time for this conversation, and best wishes to you.
All right. Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program is from the Morning Show Archives, an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2007. I'm very honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with journalist Tom Segev, very, very well known as a columnist for Israel's leading newspaper and the author of several different books about the history of his country. The author most recently of a book which at its heart is about a very crucial year in the history of Israel and the entire Middle East, 1967, Israel, the War, and the Year That Transformed the Middle East. This book is a Metropolitan book of Henry Holt and Company. And Tom Segev, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining me. Help us understand, first of all, the important events which occurred in 1967, about which I think most people have at least some acquaintance. Help us understand why all that occurred in 1967 occurred then and not 10 years earlier or 10 years later. What sorts of forces or circumstances came together in this crucial year?
In June of 1967, three wars took place, one between Egypt and Israel, one between Jordan and Israel, and one between Syria and Israel. And these wars have three different stories. It all began when Palestinian terrorists started to penetrate Israel through Syria. So there was tension along the Syrian border that then led to tension along the Egyptian border. Israelis genuinely believed that Egypt is about to destroy Israel, and so they saw no other way than take a preemptive act of war against Egypt. The story with Jordan is different. We took East Jerusalem and the West Bank in contrast to Israel's national interests. So you really have to distinguish between these different stories. They're all fascinating, and they are all very, very relevant to today.
One of the things which you challenge is the idea that war was completely unavoidable, that it was inevitable. In fact, you believe that not to be so. Tell us about that.
Israelis believed that Egypt is going to destroy them. That was very soon after the Holocaust, so you can understand that. And I think that for that reason, the war with Egypt was inevitable. But on the morning of June 5th, 1967, when Jordan attacked Israeli part of Jerusalem, Israelis set out to occupy East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and that was avoidable. The Jordanian attack did not require taking all these territories, and taking these territories contradicted Israel's national interest because they were, and they still are, populated by Palestinians. And so Israel's entire identity as a Jewish and democratic country was jeopardized. And of course, the Palestinians resorted to violent resistance, which they still do today. And so from that point of view, 1967 is still going on, the longest year.
One thing that I think is especially helpful about your book is that you really try to recreate this year of 1967, and in particular the mindset of the typical Israeli citizen.
Yes.
The sorts
yes.
of fears which they were experiencing and the way that they were seeing
yes.
the world, and in particular the way in which they saw themselves. Tell us some of the ways in which that changed so dramatically.
Israel was only 19 years old. Most Israelis had come to live in Israel after 1948. Many of them had come from Arab countries. Many of them were Holocaust survivors. Everything was new to them. They weren't sure about the future. They had, in fact, lost much of the original Zionist hope. They felt that the dream is over. So they were very, very pessimistic by 1967, which is one of the reasons why they were able to believe that they're facing another Holocaust. Today, of course, we are still facing the same problem, but we have a second and third and even fourth generation of Israelis who were born there. It is their country. They know nothing else. The Israeli identity is much stronger. In fact, Israel is much stronger. We are still troubled by the same problem of 1967. But I think that you really can't compare young Israelis of today with young Israelis of 1967. Young Israelis of today have a very strong identity as Israelis. In 1967, everything was still new, temporary. Who knows?
Well, and you talk of how For so many Israelis at that moment in time, their concern really above all else was one of just simple survival. I mean, for them as individuals and for them as a state, that was very, very much
yes.
in doubt.
You know, one of the things I did for this book was to go to Israelis who have been living in this country for many years and tell them, get up the attic and down the basement and look for letters you received from Israelis in 1960. I was able to collect about 500 such letters, which is a lot. And you really see in these letters a great anxiety for the future, both as individuals and for the future of the country. And so from letters which reflect what people felt personally, these are letters from a woman to her daughter, from a man to his brother, very personal letters. And you can see that there is no doubt in their minds that Egypt is out to destroy them. And so I think that sheds a very different light on the decision to start the war. It's not about strategy. It's not so much about military or diplomacy. There were way out of the conflict. It's about psychology. It's about fear. It's about weakness.
That might have something to do also with some of the events which followed the immediate conflict, and namely the whole issue of Palestinian refugees. Tell us what you think is most crucial about the way in which that matter was handled.
One of the shocks of 1967 is that there are so many refugees around. When I grew up and we said Arabs, we meant Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. We never thought of the Palestinians as a factor in the conflict. After 67, all of a sudden, we are faced with hundreds of thousands of people who live in very, very miserable conditions, mostly on the Gaza Strip. And the government plans to move these people from Gaza to the West Bank. Prime Minister Eshkol does. And the plans are worked out, and they don't cost a lot. They're talking about $40 million for 10 years, which even then was not a lot. And so it was possible to move hundreds of thousands of refugees from Gaza to the West Bank and give them permanent homes. Imagine if we had done that. Imagine how much easier the situation would be today, how much less misery we would be facing today. But it wasn't done. And I think that was a major mistake. The reason why it wasn't done was because people in the government, Begin, Dayan, Alon, thought that the West Bank should be kept empty for Jewish settlement. And of course, Jews were moved into the West Bank. And with every settler in the West Bank, it is more difficult to make peace. So that is, again, the problem we are facing today. And I think that was probably the major mistake of 1967.
Right. Is it difficult for you to write about that and to state that point of view? I mean, does it make you uncomfortable at all?
It makes me uncomfortable to find out that this is the way it was. It's not, and it's of course very fascinating to find out. I mean, I love writing and I love my work, and I'm always fascinated by the story. The story of 67 is really exciting.
As
but
is
it's
your
not difficult in the way you mean that we have no Salman Rushdies in Israel. We have a very, very open discussion. You can say whatever you want. People will accept it or not, and there's a great debate going on. Actually, this book did very, very well. Many, many Israelis read it, and I'm glad they did, because it's also relevant for today.
Tom Segev, and his book is 1967. Thank you so much for talking about
Thank
it
you.
Today on The Morning Show. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with Wayne Johnson, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, talking about his lovely memoir, The Iowa That Was, Memories of an Iowa Boy Turned Philosopher. And on Wednesday, we pay tribute to sports writer John Feinstein, who passed away last week, highlighting several different interviews that I've had the pleasure of conducting with him over the years. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today's going to be sunny, windy, and mild. A high today of 53 degrees, winds up to 35 miles per hour. Clear, windy, and cold overnight. Our low, 38 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny and a high of 56. Wednesday, some clouds rolling in along with some rain. Wednesday's high, 58 degrees. Thursday, sunshine should return, but a little chillier with a high of just 43. We rebound into the 50s on Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine, Elk.